Hey, you're listening to a podcast from Asian Efficiency. My name is Aaron.
Hey, this is Tan.
And today we want to talk to you about how culture affects your productivity. So this is a podcast we've actually wanted to do for a while, and it's based on a lot of discussions that Tan and I have had, both between ourselves, with our readers, our customers, and with a lot of our friends. You know, it's interesting how much society and how our upbringing shapes our ability to work, our ability to be productive, and well, pretty much all of our inherent skills are shaped by, you know, what we learn when we're younger. And a big part of that is the culture that we grew up in, or the culture that we live in. So to start us off, Tan and I are going to talk very briefly about our own backgrounds, so you can kind of get the sense of where we're coming from. And then we're going to talk about cultural norms in different places around the world that we've been, that we've worked in. And then the rest of this podcast is going to be about different environmental factors and about some of the big concepts when it comes to culture and productivity, you know, like collective working environments, individualistic cultures, and then this idea of self-development and why it's really important to your productivity. So, Tan, let's hear a bit about yourself.
Sure. So, for those who are listening, I look Asian, but I'm actually Dutch. So I actually have a Dutch passport and I speak Dutch, which is kind of weird for an Asian looking guy. But my parents are from Vietnam and I grew up in the Netherlands. So we moved there when I was really young, you know, a couple months old, really. And spent most of my life there, you know, grew up there, went to high school. And then after that, I went to college in the US here in LA. Did that for a while and then, you know, really got to learn what the US is all about. And after college, I started working for a couple of years, and then I left the U.S. again, did some traveling around the world, especially around Asia, and that really gave me sort of a different perspective on life and how people go about doing things. So a lot of that is sort of a reflection of my experiences in all those different countries I've lived in. So, for example, I lived in Hungary, which is a country in Eastern Europe, very poor country. But I had an amazing time when I lived there for a year. You know, I lived in Thailand for a while and in other parts of Asia. So all these different countries have different cultures, have different ways of doing things. And just living there gave me sort of a perspective on how people view life, on how they, you know, attack problems, how they do things. And it's very different from what I've seen in the rest of the world. So I'm going to share a little bit about that a little bit later. But before we get into that, it's probably a good idea that, Aaron, you share some of your background.
Yeah, so like Tan, I obviously look Asian. I was actually born in Sydney and I grew up there. My parents were first-generation immigrants. They actually immigrated twice, once from China to Thailand and then once from Thailand to Australia. So I guess my cultural background is a very weird mix of Confucianism, Buddhism. My mum is Catholic, and my mother's family is very matriarchal. All the women have the power in the family, which is quite interesting. And then, of course, when I went to school, you know, I grew up with Australian values of mateship, of, you know, the idea of Australia being this harsh land with an outback, and people having to be tough to make it in that world, even though, you know, if you go to Australia nowadays, it's completely not like that. It's a very modern society, and a lot of these values actually create a lot of problems within Australian society. So I've spent time living overseas, especially in the US. I spent a few years there, and the culture there is obviously very different, even from another Western country like Australia. And I also spent a lot of time traveling around Europe and Asia, and I met a lot of people who I call digital nomads. So this is a subculture in and of itself, where you have people from all around the world. You can call them expats who, you know, work remotely, work online, work from their laptops, and they have their own very unique way of doing things and their own way of seeing the world, which I won't get into in this podcast. So right now I'm in Asia, where, you know, I've kind of sat down and put all this together and been like, okay, so, you know, where you live, where you grew up, who you associate with has a huge impact on your ability to do work and be productive, and it changes what you do and the results of what you do quite a bit. So with that, let's get into the meat of this podcast. and talk a bit about cultural norms. Culture is one of those things that affects the way we work because it exerts a social pressure on us to act in certain ways when we're at work. As an example, here in Thailand, when you go to work, it is expected that you make friends and become best buddies with the people that you work with in order to get things done. You know, so say you need someone to pull a report from a IT system at work, right? So it's not enough that their job position or that their job responsibilities involve pulling reports for people, but they actually have to like you in order for them to pull that report for you, which is very odd if you think about it, especially coming from a Western frame. You know, like, I've worked in big companies in Australia, and it's kind of like, if you need something, you know, you write the person an email, or you go to their desk, or you call them up and be like, hey, you know, I kind of need this to do this, and they're like, I'm busy right now, but can I get it to you by close of business? And you're like, sure, thanks, mate. And that's the end of it, right? In Thailand, you can ask them, and they'll be like, oh, you know, yeah, I'll try. And then maybe a week later, they have still haven't gotten it to you. But their best friend in the marketing department can ask them, and then they'll drop everything and do it for them straight away, which, you know, not to bash on the culture, but it just seems to be a very inefficient way of working when the entire team has to be, well, you know, best buddies and very, very good friends in order for it to operate. Now, every country has a different working culture. So as a contrast to Thailand, another place I've spent a lot of time is Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong is interesting in that it's actually a very efficient city, and that people are extremely responsible for what they do, right? If they're supposed to do something, they'll do it. They may not be the most enthusiastic about it, but they will get it done if they need to. Another couple of countries I want to mention are Japan, which is known for being very efficient, very organized, and also very rigid in terms of working culture. So if something is specified as someone's job, they'll get it done, absolutely no problem. But they'll get it done to 100% specification, and they'll typically won't be very much variation, and as a result, I guess it's become a bit of a stereotype that the Japanese lack in the creativity department when it comes to innovative ideas and that kind of stuff. A country that Tan and I visited while we were both here was Singapore, and I guess they've been popping up on everyone's radar very recently. Now, a very, very interesting thing about Singapore, and something I actually have a lot of respect for, is everyone in the country has this overriding belief that as a people, as Singaporeans, and as a country, they can do anything. And this belief rises almost to the level of arrogance, if it wasn't so impressive. So we have a friend who runs a very successful social media agency in Singapore, and we were talking about, you know, hey, when your company gets acquired, what are you going to do? And he's like, well, I'm going to get into the financial sphere, into the financial industry. I'm like, well, do you have a background in finance, in banking? He's like, no, you know, I just need to learn a few things. These are things I need to know. Then it's really easy. Then I can just do it. Now, that kind of belief in one's own ability and skills and the ability to acquire resources is extremely, extremely good for productivity and for your ability to work, right? You know, if you think about it, we all have these ideas that, you know, oh, do we know enough? Are we smart enough to do something? In Singapore, you know, most people I've met there have, they just think, you know, if I need to do something, I'll just learn it. If I don't know it, I can learn it. If I need to find someone, I can, you know, just network with them and talk to them, and we can do it. It's like almost a matter of fact thing for them. So Tan, do you want to talk a bit about America and Europe?
Sure. So I think that's very different from what you just said. Although in the US, there's sort of a culture of like, maybe it's more of a subculture, but there's always stuff that can be done. It's just a matter of trying to figure out how. Especially because the innovation here is so ridiculously good. People are always doing research, you know, on stuff. So there's not really a barrier of like, you know, can it not be done? It's always, you know, people always ask, you know, how can it be done and how can we do it faster? You know, that's not to say that it's always the case in every single part of the country. You know, when it comes to like, for example, infrastructure, I mean, some of the infrastructure in the US is not the greatest, which definitely, you know, hampers your productivity. You know, take, for example, public transport in LA, you know, that just is just horrible, even though all the technology is there to make it, you know, really efficient. But in general, the technology here is just really good. And the culture here is more of like a hero story. Like, people really value career success and individual glory. That's why, like, this culture here has this sort of temperature where people celebrate, you know, career advancement. So if you, you know, the typical American story is starting from the bottom and making it to the top, right? Especially if you're an immigrant. And that's, you know, people refer that as the American dream. And that sort of mindset is all over the country. So it's very focused on the individual. And you see this in sports, for example, as well. Like basketball, for example, it's very focused on the individual superstars. In American football, it's all about the quarterback, right? So there's always like, there's always this focus on this one individual that rises to the top and people celebrate that. Now, that's very different from, for example, the Netherlands, where I grew up, where it's almost weird if you stand out. Like, people over there want to blend in. They don't want to stand out. Like, everything has to be sort of a team effort. And people don't really celebrate heroes. They celebrate team effort. So it's a very different culture in that aspect that, you know, individualism is not really celebrated. Like, people don't find it strange, but it's just like, you know, the mantra over there is don't be crazy, you know, act like everyone else. That's sort of the culture there. So, you know, if you do something really well as an individual, you know, that's great, but people don't celebrate it as much as, you know, team effort. So like all the Olympic sports, like all the stuff that the Dutch are good at are usually team sports. So it's like, you know, football or soccer, hockey, and all that. So it's all team sports. Like, it's just a different reflection of the US. And, you know, that's not to say that one culture is necessarily better than another. It's just a a different mindset of going about things. Especially when you're traveling, you're going to one of these countries that we just talked about, it's just something you want to be aware of.
Yeah, and I mean, the result of that is obviously growing up in a different culture or living in a different culture for a while affects the way you start to see things. One thing that I've noticed here in Asia is this idea of superficiality. I'll give you an example. So in Asia, you know, say you show up at the bank wearing t-shirt and shorts and flip-flops. People will just look at you weird and be like, what are you doing here? You obviously have no money. You obviously have no business in a bank. Please leave. Now, the same person can walk in 5 minutes later wearing a business suit and a tie, and the branch manager will come out and greet them and ask them if there is any way that they can get more of their business. Now, in a business context, I don't know about people listening, but I just find that kind of silly. You know, you can't judge people based on their immediate appearance, or, you know, you don't know anything about them in a business context, right? In a personal context and in terms of first impressions and networking and stuff, sure. You know, we need to do it because it's a huge time saver for us, right? We look at someone and we kind of shape up or size up who they are and what they're about, and then we form an impression of them. But in a business context where, you know, you're supposed to respect all your customers and treat them well, it's very, very silly to have a culture that can't see beyond the superficial appearance. And, you know, there's an obvious carry-on from that, which is a lot of people then waste a lot of time in generating all these smokescreen appearances rather than actually getting real work done and delivering real value to their customers and business partners. Now, in America, you know, the stereotype of Americans around the world is that it's an extremely superficial culture where consumerism is rampant, where it's all about image, about, you know, being, I guess the Wall Street thing is being the big swinging dick, being, you know, top of your game, being the celebrity, the superstar, right? This is completely not true. Americans, by far and large, work very, very hard. And in certain pockets, especially around the San Francisco area, America is probably the most innovative culture on the planet today. Now, of course, you know, if you go to certain parts of maybe Southern California, different places around the US, yeah, sure, you can find a certain degree of superficiality. And you can even find superficiality to the point where it affects people's ability to work. But by and far, most things actually work in America quite well, as compared to, you know, certain parts of Asia I've been to where it just goes to the point of silliness, how much people base things entirely on appearance. And as an interesting aside, it's worth noting that American presidents tend to be superstars and celebrities. You know, that goes back to what Tan said before about individual high-achieving cultures. And then if you look at, you know, Asia, like, you take a look at, like, the premier of China, right? He could be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, you know, dressed in a very plain suit and nobody really knows who he is. He's not a superstar. He's not promoted the way that, you know, the US president is as an institution. So, you know, even at the level of government, culture seeps through, obviously. and affects how a country is run, which can't help but to affect how businesses and how we as professionals, you know, go about our work. Something else in Asia that I guess should be explained is this idea of saving face. Now, you know, it's probably received enough attention in the West that most people listening to this are aware of what it is. Basically, it's the idea that you shouldn't have to suffer embarrassment at the hands of other people or yourself in public. So, you know, I grew up in a Western country, and, you know, I'm sure Tan's experiences are quite similar. Like, most people who grew up in the West or Anglosphere just don't really care, right? Like, you mess up, you say sorry, you know, no one's going to give you a hard time about it. There's no real guilt or shame or anything about it. You know, maybe a little bit of embarrassment, but by the part, you're going to live and see another day, right? In Asia, and especially in collective cultures, they can't do this. The idea of being seen to have done something wrong or done something bad or not be smart enough or whatever it is so bad that people will do really silly things to try to get out of it. The obvious example is people just abdicate responsibility, right? They'll just be like, it wasn't my responsibility. You know, Sarah over there was responsible for it. And then they'll just throw it off to someone else. And as we all know, personal responsibility and the ability to take responsibility is pretty much the bedrock of productivity. If you're not responsible, you can't be productive, right? Because you don't take ownership of what it is you're doing. So by far and large, this whole exercise of saving face, I personally think it's quite silly. I can see why people do it because it helps, you know, you fit into a collective culture, but they need to start to realize that there is a line somewhere where it stops them from actually doing what they need to do. Give you a non-work example. So in Asia, when you catch a cab, if you're a foreigner, they will usually quote you a different price, right? They want to turn off the meter, charge you like maybe 5 times your fare, and, you know, essentially scam you, right? Now, if you call them out on it, you'd be like, hey, you know, let's just switch on the meter. I know it's going to cost about this much. Oh, I'll give you this much. The taxi drivers won't go for it because going for it would be them admitting that they tried to cheat you, and that would make them a bad person in their eyes, and they quote unquote lose face. All right. So what they'll do is they usually scream at you to get the fuck out of their cab. I'll have to edit that. And then they drive around for 30 minutes with no customer. Which is kind of silly, right? They're obviously not making money with those 30 minutes when they could have made a standard fare with you in their cab. So related to this idea of saving face is another very unique part of Asia, is this idea of cheating the system. So in Asia, it is actually seen as a sign of intelligence to get one up over other people by gaming the system, by being a little bit corrupt, by taking money under the table. So they really don't want to do things properly. They see that anyone who does that, who tries to be a straight shooter, you know, which we're all encouraged to be in the West, Asian people, by and large, see that as a sign of stupidity, right? They're like, well, why aren't you on the take as well? Why aren't you, you know, getting in on this? You know, it's done here. It's completely normal. Everyone's doing it. You know, why not, right? And this can be anything from, you know, accepting bribes, from giving bribes to using personal connections for business or political gain, and or just, you know, cutting corners to bring down costs and put more money in your own pocket, right? Now, if you live in Asia and you do business here, you kind of have to get used to this, and you just have to accept that it's part of doing business. God knows how many bottles of whiskey I have bought for various people, you know, just to make things go smoother here. But you know, our opinion is this, like, especially, you know, if you're coming from a Western frame, it's like, yeah, shortcuts are great. If you know how to grease the wheels, that's good. But the line needs to be drawn somewhere where, you know, what you do actually delivers suboptimal quality and starts creating problems for other people. And, you know, if you get caught, don't try to cover it up. Just be like, oh, I thought it was acceptable, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the funny thing is, in Asia, I've been in various situations where people have, like, put money under the table to government officials. And, you know, the government official will just politely decline and be like, thank you very much for your offer, but it's okay. I can just do it. You don't have to give me, you know, the extra money on the table. It's actually quite funny to see. It's so normal here that it's part of the accepted culture.
Now, that's very different, though, from what it is like in the West. I mean, if you compare that to sort of the U.S., there's sort of this culture
It's bureaucratic a little bit in the U.S., like, it's ordered in America, and, you know, you could never walk into a store and bribe someone, right?
Yeah.
But Not to say that it doesn't have its own set of problems. It's just, I guess it's just different.
Well, it's different, but also here, the U.S., it's sort of like there are no shortcuts, even though people are looking for shortcuts. It's just that you have to put in the time, work really hard, and you'll get what you want to get.
Mm.
Right? Whereas...
That's a really good point.
You know, in Asia, it's more of like, well, you know, how can I cheat the system to get what I need? So that's very different. And obviously here, if you get caught, you know, bribing people, then, you know, you're in big trouble. But in Asia, you know, my impression is sort of like that's less of a problem. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's just a different way of, you know, getting things done. If, you know, if you're, like you said, if you're coming from a Western frame and you go there and it really frustrates you to get stuff done there because of that, you know, you just have to either, you know, accept it as it is and play the game like that, or, you know, fix the problem at its root cause, which, you know, is very, very different and not necessarily something you want to always go after anyway, because...
It's definitely not the best use of your time either to try to change all the people here.
Yeah, exactly.
Here being Asia. Yeah, just, you know, just learn to work with the system.
Yeah, so like I said, with the US, it's like, you know, put in the time, work really hard, and, you know, you'll get rewarded eventually. So it's you know, it's just different.
Yeah. You know, related to that is the American drive for success. What I'll say about it is if you've never been to the US, you owe it to yourself to go there at least once and to go spend some time around the people who are building great companies, who are developing their visions of changing the world, and to get that reference experience, because it is a very, very powerful experience. I've never ever seen anything like it, and I don't think anything like it exists on Earth. Just the sheer amount of willpower that people have to really do things.
Yeah, it's something, you know, it's something in the air that really causes that, I think. Like, every time I come back to the U.S., even, you know, from vacation or wherever, especially when I come to L.A., I can just feel that drive, like, everywhere. LA is strange in the sense that most people who live here are not from here. They're all from different cities, different parts of the world, because they want to make it, you know, in Hollywood. You know, they want to become famous and, you know, work their tails off to, you know, really be successful. Yeah, it's like you don't see this anywhere else. Like, seriously, like, so if you've never been to Los Angeles or like San Francisco and been around like other very successful people, like, you should definitely, you know, try that out and see how that affects your productivity, because I will bet money on it you'll be instantly more productive.
Yeah, as a contrast to that, you know, there are certain parts of the world where there's this idea of indolence, which is the concept of not really needing to do anything at all. So there are certain cultures in the world where they really believe that the world or the government or a big company or someone will provide everything they need for them. You can see this a lot in countries that have either a lot of natural resources or that have very strong social security networks, right? It almost breeds something of a culture of laziness. So if you happen to be from a place where this is true, for example, I'm from Australia, we have a great social security network, we have free public healthcare. Government will, you know, step in, give you housing, give you all sorts of stuff, right? The problem is it creates like almost like a false security. In you kind of like, you know, it's okay. You know, I don't really have to do much. I can just sit around and surf all day and, you know, collect my check at the end of the week and that'll be that. If you want to be productive, if you want to get your work done, if you want to do good things, you cannot let this be part of your cultural makeup. You need to recognize it for what it is, which is laziness, and to shed it as quickly as possible. Okay, so one other cultural thing that we've seen around the world is this idea of luck and fortune contrasted with the idea of action. So Tan just mentioned, you know, in America, it pretty much comes down to knowing what you want, doing stuff towards it, and you get it, right? In America, there is a certain degree of red tape, but you can pretty much still do what you want. And, you know, you can really make it in America, unlike other places around the world. The opportunity's there, right? There's nothing stopping you. Now, in Asia, it's pretty interesting because people don't really understand hard work in that context. They don't see the link between doing stuff and then getting results delivered. They see the link between doing stuff, letting fortune or luck intervene somewhere in the process, and then getting stuff. So again, with taxi drivers, some interesting conversations I've had with taxi drivers here, you know, they complain. They're like, oh, you know, so-and-so who drives that taxi, he makes about 5 times what I do every day. And I'm like, well, what does he do? And they're like, oh yeah, he has a bunch of like partners who are his regular clients and who call him when they're in town, and he just drives around all day and charges a flat rate, right? And his, and then the taxi driver's like, oh, you know, I'm just not that lucky. I don't know how to meet these people. You know, I just wasn't meant to be rich. I just wasn't meant to, you know, make money driving a taxi. And I'm like, well, why don't you go to a bookstore, pick up a language CD on how to learn English or French or German or Russian, and, you know, while you're sitting there waiting for your next fare, just listen to the CD. And that way, you know, when a foreigner does step into your cab, you can explain to them that you have your services on offer for a flat rate as well. Or you can make more money. And to them, it's like, this is a completely foreign idea. It's like they've never heard of this before. You know, they don't know that they can actually do stuff to better their own position or their own job or their work. You know, that's just a simple example of like the role that luck and fortune plays in the way that people work in Asia. You know, and it goes back to that idea of shortcuts and cheating the system. I guess the way I would sum up a lot of Asian culture is that they look for the lottery ticket, the winning lottery ticket in everything that they do, right? They look for the loopholes, the way to quote-unquote hack the system, and usually not in a very honest way either, right? And usually in the way that doesn't involve them actually doing anything or putting any real effort in. We are here telling you, you know, luck is one of those things that you work hard and you put in the time and you be productive and you do what you're supposed to be doing and it'll come along, right? I don't remember exactly which Eastern philosophy it is, but there is the idea that there are two types of luck. There is, you know, heavenly luck, which is the luck that God or the world at large or our collective consciousness gives you, right? It's like a random stroke of good stuff happening to you. And then there is the luck that you make yourself, which comes from basically doing stuff and then looking for opportunities. And then when you spot them, you go for them. That is the luck that we can control. That is a luck that makes you more productive because you'll be doing stuff and you'll be taking advantage of opportunities that you've created for yourself. And I guess as a cultural trait, that's the kind of luck that you want to have. Do you want to add anything to that, Tan?
Yeah, I think it's so true because in Asia, it's like you said, like they try to win the lottery ticket and everything else gets blamed on someone else. So if someone else is more successful, it's because they're lucky. It's not because, you know, they really worked hard for it. And it's sort of that victim mentality that they have in the sense that they don't really believe that they can do it. It's just like you either have it or you don't, or you're in that situation or you're not. And yeah, if you're listening to this, this might sound really crazy to you already, but you know, a lot of people around the world, they don't understand that you can put yourself in, you know, good situations if you work on it. So just by, you know, improving yourself, you know, learning new skills and focusing on growing, you know, to be your best self, you know, a lot of that will, you know, translate into good things, right? As long as you put in the time and really work for it. A lot of people just don't understand that. And, you know, that's like, I'd say more than 90% of people or so are like that. So, you know, the fact that you're listening to this and you probably get it. And that's why this concept that Aaron just talked about is, you know, will probably like be absurd to you. But that's like how majority of people live, you know, and it's yeah, unfortunate, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, just to cap off this section, I want to mention a couple of things to expand on what you just said about the victim mentality. You remember when we were in Portland recently, like we saw a lot of like young homeless people, like a lot of young couples and people living on the street. And it, you know, a couple of our friends, Mark and Angel, made the observation that they're not there because they have to be; they're there by choice, to prove a point to society or their parents or the government or, you know, whoever the man or the institution happens to be. And that's just silly, right? You're like victimizing yourself for no real reason, trying to shift blame and responsibility to other people when really you can, you know, make the most of your life and do the right thing.
Yeah.
That's something to be aware of, I guess. You know, if for however reason that's crept into the makeup of your culture and how you think, it's not good. Yeah, obviously, if you're listening to this, it's probably also a very foreign idea to you. but just be aware that those people do exist and that they do try to spread their message to other people. And it's not a very productive one.
Yep.
Yeah. The last thing I wanted to mention in this section on cultural norms is this idea of role models. So Asia, where I live, is a very religious part of the world, right? And I'm talking, you know, all the way from Islam in the Middle East, stretching through to Buddhism, you know, all its variants across Asia. The interesting thing about this is that you can take one religion, like Buddhism, and each country's interpretation of it is going to be completely different. And they emphasize different aspects of the religion. So Buddhism in, say, India, China, and Southeast Asia are all completely different, right? So Buddhism in China, it's a strain of Buddhism called Mahayana Buddhism or something like that. But it focuses on the individual, it focuses on ancestor worship, on, you know, following certain values in your life and doing stuff, right? Buddhism here in Thailand is called Theravada Buddhism, and it is a communal-based Buddhism centered around temples and monks. And so people go pray at temple, they give alms at temple to get karma, and they look to someone else as a source of their salvation rather than try to improve themselves as a human being. You'll notice that this is the same Buddhism that exists around the world, but it's just that the interpretation here is so different. You know, that's how powerful culture is. Like, it shapes religions. The run-on effect of that is those religions in turn shape the country's culture and the way that people see things. So this idea of, like, you know, looking to an external source or an external authority for your luck, fortune, and ability to work really comes in places like Thailand, where, you know, everything from religion to government and everything, that people look to other people for blame. In contrast, that with the Chinese, who, you know, obviously are doing very well in the world right now, I think a big part of that, apart from their population size and certain other factors, is their main religion, if you can call it that, is very much based around Confucianism, you know, traditional Chinese values, and based around the variant of Buddhism that is really about the self as opposed to the community. Another interesting thing about this is the different interpretations of a religion or culture, you know, they set the standards of behavior for what is acceptable in society, right? The problem is that most people don't work just within their own society, but they, you know, most people at their jobs have to deal with people overseas or deal with foreigners or deal with expats nowadays. So you are going to come across people who don't share your values at work, and something has to give on one side. I guess the classic example, you know, is anyone who's ever done business with the Chinese, right? The way that they look at the world, that the way that they think that things work, is so different from the West. I was in New Zealand last year, and there are a bunch of very noisy Chinese tourists there who expected people there to speak Mandarin. They're like, you know, we're one of the most powerful countries on earth. Everyone in China speaks Mandarin. Why don't you? And it's just interesting to see, like, that's such a degree of self-sabotage, right? Like, as we all know, English will get you by almost anywhere in the world. Russian in large parts of the world, you know, obviously Arabic and Spanish in other parts. Chinese, you know, by and large, is really largely confined to China and various Chinatowns around the world, right? Overseas Chinese communities. But this, you know, this expectation that they've grown up with, that, like, China is the world, and then going out into the world at large and realizing that this is not true, creates a huge inefficiency in their ability to do business, in their ability to relate to other people around the world. And I guess the takeaway from this is, if we have anything like this ourselves, we need to be aware of it and to spot it and to address it, right? Okay, and so we're back. Ironically, while we were recording the first half of this podcast, power in my condominium actually cut out. So there you go. Asia is not actually all that efficient in real life.
Yes.
So where we left off, we were talking about cultural norms, you know, so things like how superficial a culture is and how that affects people's productivity, why in Asia they like to cut corners, and why America really still is the most innovative culture in the world. So moving on from that, we want to talk about something a little different, what we call external factors, quote unquote. These are kind of things in the environment. So the things that you really don't control as a person, it's something that, you know, through whatever circumstance just happens to be part of a country's makeup. To start it off, one really interesting measure of how productive a country is actually the number of public holidays that they have and the government policies around how employees and businesses can operate on public holidays. So as a couple of examples, here in Thailand, we have a lot of public holidays. In fact, I would say that we have at least 2 public holidays every single month, if not more. And this is not even counting, you know, the longer holidays like Thai New Year or over the Christmas period. Contrast this with a country like Singapore, which I believe has less than 10 public holidays throughout the entire year, most of those being, you know, stuff like New Year's, Chinese New Year, and Christmas. Something else that we found interesting is this idea of the presence of seasons. So, grew up in Australia, where we have 4 seasons. I'm used to the idea that the weather gets hot, it gets cold. Something that one of my friends told me was that any country that has seasons has a population that knows how to do long-term planning, because, you know, if you have an upcoming winter, you need to prepare for it. You need to stock your grain, stock your food supplies, you know, you need to project your future needs over that cold period of time. Now, if you're from a country where there are no seasons, again, I'm going to pick on Thailand here, everything seems to be more last minute. You know, in Thailand, there's actually a saying in Thai that, you know, if you want to eat something, you just go to the tree or the land, pick it up, and then you can eat. There's no real need to worry about having to stockpile food or having to prepare for, you know, a long winter or a particularly bad winter or crops that don't yield. Related to that is the idea of how easy it is to survive in terms of very, very basic survival needs. So if you take a country like Singapore, which has absolutely no natural resources, everything that they've done, they really have to do based on their own ingenuity and their own ability to produce, which I guess is part of the reason they have that belief that they can do anything and everything. A country that's similar to that is Japan. You know, the only real natural resource that Japan has is fish, right? The rest of their country is pretty mountainous, pretty horrible for farming in general. Contrast that with, like, you know, say the USA, where you have a ton of grazing land, or Europe, where agriculture was quite well developed. And you can see that the mindsets that emerge as a result of natural resources or seasons affects how people actually work and go about their lives.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it actually makes a lot of sense if you think about it, but I don't think a lot of people realize that, you know, that the history of agriculture in their country plays such a huge part in how the current population goes about doing things, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the argument you made about the seasons actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Like, if there's no need to plan ahead because, you know, the food is always going to be there because the sun is always going to be there, I can see how, you know, that sort of facilitates to do things last minute because, you know, you don't have to plan.
You just don't need to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense.
Which is a good thing, right, for people living there. But
yeah,
when you then take those people and throw them out into the world where planning is an essential skill, you know, especially for work, yeah, that creates problems.
Now, going back to the holiday thing, like, one thing I want to bring up as well is the idea of, like, how many holidays people get, or, like, pay time off, as they call it in the U.S. So, like, here in the U.S., it's, you know, sort of accepted that you can only take, like, up to 14 days off throughout the year. And, you know, if you get sick or something, then that, you know, that goes against your paid time off. So what they call PTO, right? So every year you have 14 days to take, you know, time off. And if you get sick, you know, you take one day off that. And, you know, that will be paid time off. So you actually get paid when you're sick. But, you know, if you're sick over 14 days, then you don't get paid, right? Now, if you compare that to, for example, the Netherlands, where I grew up, I think people over there have like 30 days paid time off. And it's quite normal, like, in the summer to be gone for like a whole month or for like 3 weeks. Like, here in the US, I sort of get the impression that if you're gone for like more than 10 days, like, yeah, there's going to be someone, you know, waiting for, you know, to take over your job by the time you get back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of weird to me, but...
Yeah, I would definitely change people's mindsets as to how hard they need to work, stuff like that.
Yeah, like, in the Netherlands, it's... I don't know, the culture is sort of like, you know, do your thing, government will, you know, help you out if you don't, you know, don't make it. Here in the U.S., it's kind of like, you know, hey man, if you're fired, you don't have a job, you know, that's your problem. Like, you know, you're pretty much on your own, which in a way is a good thing because it stimulates you to work hard and, you know, to always do your best. Because there's nothing, you know, to rely on when things go sour. But yeah, it's just something to be aware of, I think.
That's interesting. Yeah, I guess related to that, we have a note on what's called working culture in different countries. So I mean, Tan's talked about paid time off, how that changes how you think about how you approach your work. You know, something interesting that I learned very recently, actually, when I came here to Asia, is that people here see it as completely normal to keep working until you die. I know that sounds kind of morbid, but you know, in Western countries, like in Australia, you know, when you turn 55 or 60, you start thinking about retirement at 65, right? You're like, you know, I'm going to stop working. I'm going to cash in my, we call it superannuation. I guess in America, they call it their 401k, you know, their retirement plans, social security, that kind of stuff. And, you know, just retire and like read books, write, you know, do all the things that you wanted to do when you were younger, but didn't because you were working.
Which is Asia, totally strange when you think about it, but okay.
Yeah, it's pretty bizarre. Yeah.
that's a podcast for another time.
Yeah. In Asia, they actually believe that if you stop working, you die.
Yes.
So people here, they work until they're in their 70s and 80s. They believe that it keeps you mentally sharp, it keeps you healthy, and it keeps you focused. And after being here for a while, I tend to agree with them. If you just sit around and do nothing all day, you're not being productive. You're not doing what you were put here on Earth to actually do, you know, which if you link it all together, it's some variation of helping other people or bettering humanity or even helping just yourself. If you stop doing that, well, you know, it gets really boring and your brain switches off, your body switches off, and you just work less. So, you know, in the Western world, we have this big thing about, oh, I'm gonna work for X number of years, I'm going to make so much money, and then, you know, I'm going to retire and live the good life, right? But we all know successful entrepreneurs who, you know, after selling their companies for millions of dollars, then come back and be like, okay, what's next? Let's do something else. Because they recognize as well that, yeah, it's nice to take breaks, it's nice to take time off. But there is something about work and doing productive things that I would say is essential to living healthy and living a good life.
Yeah, my grandma is like that, you know? Like, she's in Vietnam, and she's, I think, you know, like, somewhere in her 70s. And she still does, like, you know, random jobs. Because, like, otherwise, she told me, like, she's super bored. Like, she doesn't want to hang out with, like, old people at home doing nothing. And, like, you know, but, you know, she walks a lot, you know? She's old, she walks a lot, she takes the bus. Like, she does a lot of things, and man, her memory is amazing. And, you know, for an old woman like that, I'm just like, whoa. You know, compare that to a lot of other elderly people I see that, you know, don't do anything after 65, you know. I think it's actually the way to go to be active in that sense. You know, like a lot of people, you know, they go into retirement houses or communities and, you know, enjoy a good time. And, you know, that's totally fine, but I get the impression that they're very bored. A lot of the times, especially if you don't have anything, you know, interesting going on in your life besides bingo and, you know, playing checkers with other people.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to bring it back to, like, you know, people of working age who aren't elderly yet, get used to the idea that, you know, you're going to keep working, whether it's for money or for something you love or for something else. Like, it doesn't end. It's an ongoing journey right up to the point where you can't do it anymore. Just, you know, when you die.
Yeah, just make sure you do something you actually like to do. Like, if you do something that you absolutely hate, yeah, then I can see how retirement is actually, you know, very pleasant. And that's sort of the impression I get in the US is, like, people really don't like their jobs. Like, most people, you know, like, we've been to this conference and, you know, I've seen so many people, I've talked to so many people who just hate their jobs and would love to do something else. But they're sort of they're sort of stuck, and you know, they have to do this till retirement, and then they're sort of quote unquote free. But like Aaron, like you just said earlier, like, we know people who, you know, sold successful companies and then took time off, but then, you know, couldn't sit still because, you know, it gets really boring after a while. You know, that time might be, you know, 6 months, 1 year, or even 2 years, but it's definitely not 20 years if you're planning to retire for that long.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of America, one thing I really noticed when I was living there was they have this culture of workaholism. So, you know, if I remember correctly, like most Americans started work pretty early, like 8, 9 a.m., and then worked through to like 6, 7 p.m., if not later into the evening. I'm talking about, I guess, office jobs here. But it really amazed me because in Australia, it's very much a, you know, in at 9 sharp, out by 5, go to the pub, have a few drinks, watch the game kind of thing every single day. You know, does being a workaholic make you more productive? I would say it does, but you do need to temper it. You know, Henry Ford ran a bunch of productivity experiments, and I think they worked out that, like, the maximum, optimum number of work hours a week was about 40 hours before people started making mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, other data that we've seen, the argument would be that, like, if you're a knowledge worker, which most office people are nowadays, 35 hours is about the right amount, if you think about it. You know, so that's working 9 to 5, maybe with an hour off for lunch, 5 days a week. There's no real, you know, there may be a need to pull all-nighters to really push things through. And obviously, if you work in a high-pressure company, say an investment bank or a consulting firm, you know, they're going to expect you to put in the late hours. But in terms of your health, in terms of the actual output that you create, you know, 35 to 45 hours a week is pretty much where you want to be. So definitely love your work. Definitely go at it hard when you're doing it, but remember to take time off as well. And obviously the culture of the company or the country that you're in will have a big impact on that. Okay. The last environmental factor we want to talk about is this idea of the importance of the English language and information access. So something really interesting about this is I just read an article lately saying that the number of internet users in China now tops something like 650 million.
Damn.
Which is double the number in the US. And I think it's like more than the US plus the next 2 or 3 countries put together. So all these people are online speaking Chinese, typing in Chinese and reading in Chinese. But from what we've seen, it may be a case that a lot of these Chinese speaking internet users haven't made their way around the world and we just haven't run into that many of them yet. But from what Tan and I have seen is one of the biggest unspoken factors in productivity is access to the English language internet. And by that, I mean access to blogs, to articles, to forums, to books, to Amazon, to, you know, to anything that's written in English, because I hate to say it, but all the really great ideas online are written in English, right?
Yep.
That's where they all start. That's where all the innovation starts. And, you know, a big part of that is like America was for a long time had the largest online presence. They have huge internet penetration. Countries like Australia, the UK also have massive internet penetration. And, you know, all the good stuff was written in English. All the stuff that told you, you know, work 35 hours a week, that told you how to be productive, how to set up your morning rituals, how to manage your tasks, that was all written in English first. Now, what we're seeing is a lot of this English language stuff is being translated into native tongues, right? So a lot of our stuff gets translated into Mandarin and Russian all the time, which is, I guess, is good because more people will become more productive and everyone will do better as a whole. What's really interesting is that in countries where English isn't a priority or where it isn't taken seriously as something that people should learn, these countries suffer from a huge lack of ideas entering their collective consciousness. And as a result, they have lower productivity standards, you know, their work just isn't as fluid, and they just don't produce as much as other countries. You can read like Lee Kuan Yew's biography, and you can see why they made English one of the de facto languages in Singapore, is because they realized the importance that America and the UK and, you know, the English-speaking parts of Europe would be producing all this great stuff, and if they wanted in on it, they would have to speak English as well. As a contrast, you know, a couple of countries in Asia, so, you know, I live in Thailand, English is no longer a priority here. They're actually quite proud of their culture and their language, which they have the right to be. But, you know, the result of that is that they suffer. They don't get new ideas in from the rest of the world because there just aren't enough people here who speak fluent English or who can read and write it and translate it into Thai. Right? There's like a lag time of 4 to 5 years before all the big ideas from the rest of the world come into here. Now, the exception to this would be countries like Japan, who have always had a huge scientific and progressive brain trust. You know, there are a lot of great universities in Japan. They have their whole chunk of the internet that's entirely in Japanese that has great ideas, and they have enough people translating and bringing in ideas from the US and from the rest of the world that they don't suffer this problem the way that a country like Thailand does. So let's talk a bit about collective and individualistic cultures. Do you want to kick us off, Tan?
Sure. So this whole idea is just about how people view you and sort of how you conduct yourself. So, for example, earlier in the podcast, I talked about how in the Netherlands, it's sort of a collective culture where nobody really stands out and everyone has to sort of fit in. So if there's a project that's going on, there's not one person that's going to take all the credit, right? Whereas in the US, there's this notion that there's always this one superstar. Like, you see this in sports a lot. But you also see this in like the work culture. Like, there's always one person that, you know, is sort of the A player and wants to get all the credit for it. So you can translate this as well into sort of the culture in a country. So like I said, in the Netherlands you have that. In Asia, it's mostly a collective thing. I think former Soviet Union as well. Whereas in the US or mostly like Anglo-Saxon countries, it's more of an individualistic approach to that. So it's not necessarily good or bad, like either approach. It's just, you know, something you have to sort of live with and sort of deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think when we talked about this, we came to the conclusion that in general, people who want to be individual superstars tend to get the job done better and faster, if a little messier. And that, you know, collective cultures tend to work better than individuals, obviously, but only if everyone really gets along really well, which I guess is, you know, to someone who grew up in a Anglosphere country, that's a big ask. But, you know, in Asia, they seem to do it just fine. So I guess the productivity takeaway from this is be aware which one you prefer, and within that framework, be the most productive person you can be and try to work with other productive people. And that will just make your work results, you know, unstoppable.
Yeah, especially if you're traveling to like different places, you should pretty much pick this up as soon as possible so that, you know, there's no conflicts going on.
Yeah. Let's talk about self-development and its presence in different countries. So as surprising as it will be to everyone listening to this, there are a lot of people in the world who don't know about self-development, also called self-help, personal development, personal growth, all that kind of good stuff. You know, I've had conversations with people here in Thailand, in the Philippines, in Hong Kong, in Japan. And, you know, I tell them, like, they ask me, what do you do? I'm like, well, I work for a company called Asian Efficiency. We teach people systems and productivity. And a lot of the times they're like, oh, that's kind of cool. What's that about? And then I tell them a bit and they're like, oh yeah, we do that too. We just don't call it that. So the interesting thing is, you know, I think this heavily relates to the presence of English in a in a particular country, is a lot of people use, you know, what we term productivity hacks, systems, and, you know, the things that help you manage your tasks, your time, but they don't think about them that way. They just think of them as like, this is, you know, something my former boss taught me to do. It's the right way to do it. I'm just going to do it this way. Where this becomes a bit of a problem is a lot of these people have trouble thinking in terms of abstract concepts, which is, you know, if you're going to build an effective, say, email management system, you need to be able to conceptualize it on paper or visually first before you can implement it in real life. And, you know, abstract thinking skills, one of the things that self-development gives you is this ability to think abstractly, right? Because you're talking about concepts like growth, like processes, you know, things that don't have a physical form that you can hold on to. Now, if you're listening to this, you are probably aware of self-development and you are probably on a quest to, you know, be the best person that you can be in terms of skills and abilities and life, right? And we just want to say that that's actually a really, really good mindset, if not one of the best mindsets you can possibly have. There is a huge difference in terms of ability to do stuff between people who aspire to be better and better and people who just kind of like take things the way they are.
Yeah, I think people who sort of understand this concept are actually in the, like, I don't know, maybe top 5% or top 10% of people in the world. Like, I think the majority of people just don't understand this concept that, you know, you can actually be a better person. You know, like, you can actually improve yourself. You don't, you know, have to rely on luck or on, you know, good fortune to be in a place where you want to be. You can actually work towards that. right? And a lot of people just don't understand this concept. And if you're, like Aaron said, if you're listening to this, then you are in that sort of top 5 or 10% of people who get it, you know, and we just want to help you get there faster, right?
Yep. Okay, so Tan asked me not to actually talk about this, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. It's something called immigrant work ethic. So from our backstories, you can tell that, you know, I guess Tan and I are both second generation Asians growing up in different countries. So it may not be politically correct to say, but where a country's migrants come from has a huge impact on that country's ability to grow and be productive. So the question it comes down to is, you know, do these migrants come in and see it as an opportunity to make a better life for themselves? You know, there's that self-improvement mindset again. Or do they see it as a way to come in and take advantage of a country's welfare systems and other people's generosity? So in Australia, despite all the issues that we have had with, you know, racial riots and infighting and that kind of stuff, in general, migrants are pretty good. The model minority there are Indians and Asians who come in, get insane test scores all through school, and go on to become doctors and lawyers. Right? They move there, they work hard, or, you know, their parents work hard, the children of migrants usually end up performing really well and contributing a lot to society. I've been told by various European friends that it's not quite that way in Europe, where there are a lot of immigrants who come in, end up living off welfare and just generally causing problems in countries. And, you know, really the only difference there is, do the people coming in, do they see it as an opportunity for a fresh start, the ability to do better, or do they see it as a way to just abuse a welfare system that's set up to take care of a country's inhabitants? Tan, you want to talk a bit about transcending and overcoming culture?
Yeah. So, all of this aside, we've talked about a lot of different stuff today, and you know, some of the stuff that we've actually never, you know, written about before or even talked about before. But what we want to sort of end it up or like close with is sort of the idea of awareness. You know, not everything you've learned is always the best. And like, as you grew up and you grew up in a certain culture, you know, you adapt certain values, you learn certain methods, you learn, you know, certain mindsets. And as a result of that, it doesn't mean that you're necessarily the best version that you can be because of that, you know, because each culture, like we said, is different, has like different positives, different negatives. But if you travel around a little bit, you'll get to see all these different, you know, ways of living and mindsets that people have. And what we're trying to really instill in you is sort of all the things that we've seen and, you know, mesh that together and sort of give you sort of ideas of how you can implement this. So, you know, the first thing you have to be aware of is that, yes, you can change and yes, you can learn all these things. And like we mentioned before, like if you understand this concept of personal development or personal growth, or you're just listening to this, you already understand that, right? So you're already open for change. You just have to sort of be aware of what you want to change and add sort of to your life and grow in that aspect. So you basically have to sort of put a spotlight on that and just focus on that. Right? So the first step to any change is always awareness, right? And then once you sort of know what you want to do, then it's just repetition, just doing it over and over and over and over again. So for example, if you know that you're, you know, generally a lazy person, but you don't want to be, the first step is, you know, being aware of that and just acknowledging that, you know what, like I'm lazy. You know, maybe it's because of the culture here, you know, that, you know, you don't have to be a star performer. You can just, you know, sit on your behind and not do that much and still get stuff done. But if you are someone who wants to change and sort of develop yourself in that aspect, you know, first step is, you know, be aware that you are lazy and acknowledge that, and then set up sort of a game plan of how you're going to change that, right? And then it's just repeating that process over and over and over again. So for example, if you're lazy, then the first step that you can do is always take action regardless, right? Whether it's a small step or like a big step, always try to take action so that you don't put yourself in a state where you don't take any action or you're just procrastinating. So, you know, you can apply this in different areas, like whether that's school or at work. You just have to like sort of figure out what your plan is and then focus on that constantly all the time.
Yeah. You know, just to add to that is, because we're talking about culture and different countries around the world in this podcast, one thing I want to add is spend some time learning about different cultures and how they work, and then take the best aspects of those things and integrate them, you know, apply them for yourself. You know, so for example, from Japan, a really popular concept is Kaizen, which is the idea of constantly and always improving your business systems. And, you know, by business systems, I mean your life, right? You know, from Singapore, you can take that belief that anything is possible and that all you really need to do anything is work out how to do it and then just go ahead and do it. And, you know, no one can really stop you, right? And of course, we talked earlier about America, where if you haven't visited yet, you owe it to yourself to go there at least once and to just soak in the energy and the raw drive that the people there have to, you know, make their lives and the world a better place.
Yep.
So that's all we had. Has you got anything else, Tan?
No, that was a good podcast.
Yeah, it was really good. All right, so this has been a podcast from Asian Efficiency. I'm Aaron.
And I'm Tan. And thanks for listening.
And yeah, thanks for listening.